Congressman, there's a lot of work left on the table. When you come back in September, what do you think the priorities are going to be with regard to the House, and can you even look across the aisle and see what the Senate plans to do?
Well, it's pretty hard to figure out what the Senate might do. We've sent a lot of bills over there. In the House, the number one issue in September will be to figure out how to fund the government going beyond midnight September 30th. And that has turned into a kind of a tug of war over the years where government's being run by continuing resolution, or CR in our particular acronym that we use, the continuing resolution. If we can get that negotiated and get it passed through the House and the Senate to the President's desk, then we avoid that crisis that's coming. Beyond that, I don't think that the House is going to do very much between now and the election. They're going to want to stay below the political radar, as I think the Senate wants to do, and probably save some of these things for the lame duck session after the election.
Looking in your crystal ball with regard to this continuing resolution legislation, is it one that funds us through the election? Is it one that funds us into a lame duck session? Does it take us into 2015?
Well, I think it just is most likely to take us into 2015, and I say that because, you know, if we did a 60-day extension or a 90-day extension, I think that there will be political pushback. The public would be critical of that. If we extend the funding out into 2015 and give the next Congress an opportunity then to weigh in, that looks to me like it's pretty close to the right thing to do. Now, under what we call regular order, we would be passing appropriation bills for each of the 12 and perhaps 13 appropriations subcommittees that there are. And then that would go from the House, where the spending has to start, over to the Senate, where the Senate would weigh in, do their amendments, send it back to the House. We would go to conference and send a bill to the President's desk. That's regular order. None of that is happening. And it is, it is brinksmanship on the funding, and it's hard to predict how it will be coming down to the end. But I think that it's more likely that we do some type of continuing resolution that gets us to the next Congress rather than having to deal with it again in lame duck.
You have new players in leadership. Do you expect that to change the process with regard to the majority leader? First up is spending.
Well, I don't know that the process is likely to be the same. It'll probably change some of the decisions along the way, and we aren't going to be privy to what many of those decisions are. That'll be staff working behind closed doors, is how I would say it. It sounds a little cynical. But the change in there with Kevin McCarthy as majority leader and Steve Scalise now as the majority whip, that changes things some. I will tell you that my working relationship with them has gotten better instead of worse, and I don't know that people would have predicted that. And I think we're going to be a conference that will work better together, at least between now and November.
When we think about things that are on the table for this year, obviously there is concern about some of the tax breaks, some of the tax extenders that fell off the table at the end of 13, still not here. When we're talking at the Farm Progress Show, that Section 179 benefit might make it easier for some companies to sell farm machinery.
That's probably the section of the federal code that is actually quotable, or at least the section number is memorized by probably a majority of the people walking around here at the Farm Progress Show, Section 179. But what we're looking at is at roughly 30 tax extenders. And I do think they come up in lame duck, not between now and the election, but after the election and before the end of the year, because they really have to be done by the end of the calendar year. Almost all of them fit in that category. Generally speaking, we are of the opinion, and I'm judging from the without a vote or a whip card check on this, of the opinion that it's really all or none on the tax extenders to sort them and say these are in and these are out. When you get down into lame duck, that's not a very good thing to do. So I'm gonna predict that I think we get the tax extenders extended probably for a year only, and do so in the lame duck session after the election.
Process of the summer, finally the EPA's suggestion with the RVO for renewable fuels has been offered for analysis of OMB. They have some time to digest that. What has the delay meant to your state? What has it meant to this industry?
Well, I think that there's been a significant amount of capital that hasn't been accrued because of this delay. And the EPA, I'll just say, arbitrarily rolled back the billion gallon target that is in the statute for the renewable fuel standard, 14.4 billion gallons. And we're prepared to meet that. In fact, we'll produce that. But last year we reached the 13.68 standard, and this year it was 14.4. They ratcheted it down, though, to 13.01 billion gallons. And now the comment period has come in, and the EPA has received the comments, and they're waiting to make a decision. But I hear through the grapevine that it's likely also to be after the election. Here's my message to the EPA. Go back and read the law. It says 14.4 billion gallons. Second thing is, there's a waiver provisions that I think were stretched considerably when the EPA rolled back to 13.01 billion gallons. And now we have the largest corn crop ever. It is still in the field. Granted, it's not in the bin, but it's already adjusted in the markets, and the markets have adjusted to the EPA's lower RFS number. If the EPA is going to look objectively at the law and look at the indicators in the field, soon in the bin, they just about have to go back to 14.4 and say, well, you know, we've got a huge corn supply, and we need to put it into ethanol as the law requires.
With regard to EPA, they also are considering a definition of waters of the U.S. that, according to a map that was released, would give them a tremendous additional coverage of landmass in the U.S. and perhaps along with the Corps of Engineers. Was this in the Clean Water Act that Congress put together?
Well, of course, I wasn't there then, and quite a lot of people in America weren't born then, but about 1978, Congress passed, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Endangered Species Act. And they have used those three bills to regulate away a lot of our property rights. The EPA contends that they've always had this authority to regulate the waters of the United States. I remember in an effort to regulate protected streams by defining these streams to their geographical boundaries. This is about 1992. And, quote, waters hydrologically connected to them, close quote. That was an overreach that reached all the way from the navigable waters of the United States, which you might think the Mississippi River, the Missouri River, the Ohio River, all the way up through the tributaries, up through the tile line, through the water line, through the well, all the way to the kitchen sink, all hydrologically connected. The courts found that language, hydrologically connected, was too vague, and so when that was knocked down, now we see the EPA come back with their definition, which is the waters of the United States, not the navigable, but the waters of the United States, and where there is a significant nexus to the waters of the United States. They get to define significant nexus today, next month, next year, next generation. And we should not allow a rule to come in that's that vague, especially a rule that essentially says we're going to grant you permission to do normal farming practices along our waterways, which includes dry waterways that we mow. We're gonna let you do normal practices as they define it. And when you start defining normal practices, they had some 50 in the rule, but there are a lot of other practices out there that are omitted. Then you have to get permission for them. This is an overreach. I believe that if you take this thing to its logical extension, it is an unconstitutional takings of our property rights, and it puts the EPA in a position to regulate every square inch if they decide to do that. The map that you see now isn't limited to that because, hydric soils go well beyond that. And anything that's underwater ever is going to be within their control. So all of our river and stream bottoms would be. And I just think that we need to stop this rule. It's an overreach. It's an overzealous administration. We have one EPA administrator here on the grounds today. I wish that there were 1,000 of them and they could see what actually happens in agriculture, especially here in the heart of the heartland.
Let's take another step with regard to this, because the mechanism of government would have the Congress either to limit appropriations to affect a particular regulation, or the Congress would come together and override with a majority vote and a presidential signature that their actions are out of line. I don't see that in Washington.
Well, Congress has the constitutional authority, of course. I call it the Bill Cosby rule, and I brought you into this world, I can take you out. And the EPA was created by Congress. And I know somebody said earlier today that the EPA has claimed that they had always had this rule, always had this authority. Always had the authority, not necessarily the rule. And I would argue there wasn't always an EPA. I remember when there wasn't one. But Congress has the authority to nullify any rule that we choose. We can just bring a bill to the floor, pass it to the House, the Senate, send it to the President for a signature. That's the constitutional function, but it's a different story when you've actually got to get something done and get it passed. Our best opportunity there is in an appropriations bill to bring a line item in that appropriation bill that says no funds shall be used to implement the overreach of the EPA's rule, the significant nexus rule, I'll call it. That's our best chance to do that. The House is in a position to do that. The Senate's different because Harry Reid will block most everything we do in the House. But we do have an election coming up in November, and I'm going to suggest that if that turns out well, we'll be in a position where Congress can nullify the rule and or cut the funding off to enforce it.
There is discussion that this administration may be using executive order on some immigration policy. Your thoughts?
Well, the president has been threatening his cell phone and his ink pen for a long time on this, and it's gotten more and more intense. We sit around and watch the White House and watch them release the trial balloons to see if they burst or get shot down. This trial balloon has been released many times by the White House and the president's spokesman. And it's this: the president threatens to, by executive edict, not necessarily order, but edict, legalize, and put that word in quotes because he has no constitutional authority to do this, 9 million people that are in the country illegally. You can just about take the number they give you and multiply it by three to get to a closer number. But the point is that if the president does this, then he has gone way outside the bounds of his constitutional authority. He has stepped in, and it's figuratively this way. Imagine taking the Constitution of the United States, separate out Article 1, which gives the powers of all legislative powers to the United States Congress, tearing out Article 1 of the Constitution, sticking in his shirt pocket and saying, that's mine. I'm now going to take over the job that Congress has to do. If that happens and Americans don't rise up, I will tell you, I will go directly back to Washington, D.C. I will call for a special session of Congress to deal with this. I'll call for my colleagues to join me, and I hope John Boehner beats me to the punch on doing that. And we then have an open session, a committee of the whole, where we deal with this expected massive overreach on the part of the President of the United States. The Constitution will never have been under such threat as it would be if he goes forward with the threats that he has made.
Last thought for you. In Missouri, barely more than 2,000 votes offers a right to farm amendment to their Constitution. There are a lot of groups that are challenging our industry today. You've seen it in your home state. How do we address the divide between urban and rural and that minuscule section that is more than willing to take away the right of producers to raise food and fiber on the land?
Wait, sometimes, I'd like to think that there's a rational basis for the society that we live in, and that we have reasonable people, and they understand the underpinnings of why we live in this great country. And it is property rights, constitutional rights, the rule of law, and we need to respect everyone's rights. And when someone has a feeling and they start to turn it into emotionalism and then they act on referendum, sometimes an uninformed electorate will impose upon people something that's just, it's just ridiculous and debilitating. I would point to the California egg referendum as an example. When the people in California were convinced that they should regulate the cage size for the laying hens in California. Okay, that's fine. If California wants to regulate their producers into bankruptcy, that's up to California to do that. They have a legal right. But then the California legislature was convinced that they should pass a law that regulates egg producers everywhere else, so that when an egg shows up in the border in California, it has to be, I'll just say figuratively speaking at least, certified to be laid by a hen that was in a cage size that the Humane Society of the United States, the vegan lobby itself, had prescribed. And we can't let that happen. We can't have a state regulate production standards in every other state. If that happens, we end up with a patchwork quilt, a hodgepodge of regulations. and these hodgepodge of regulations then tie up our economy in a place that our founding fathers knew this, they experienced it. That's why they wrote the Commerce Clause in the Constitution. And when we get to court with that issue on eggs, and thanks to the Attorney General in the state of Missouri, circling back to that geography again, for initiating the lawsuit, that now I think will find California's regulation unconstitutional. If it doesn't, we'll get to the Supreme Court eventually and protect the Commerce Clause in the Constitution.